whose natural habitat is relentlessly encroached upon by the implacable advance of civilization. And, improbably, if you could ever see a whole wormhole all at once, which you can't, you'd find them just as chubbly adorable. They spend most of their time sleeping, can only consume a widely available but barely digestible substance that gradually poisons them, and respond to the process of reproduction, which everyone else finds pretty exciting, with little more than a vast cosmic ennui. They can only mate and give birth at the heat death of the universe, when all this expanding matter takes a long, hard look at its choices, peels out into a hard reverse, and rapidly compresses itself back down into a ball of white-hot everything, ready to reboot the Big Bang and start the long march of reality all over again, only this time without anyone ever inventing paperclips. The first thing that ever happens to an adorable baby wormhole is that it rather traumatically explodes. So it's hardly any wonder they're not terribly good at parties. Like kudzu roots, some small part of them remains forever in that continuous moment of detonating lava and life, while the rest of them is flung into every part of space and time by the sheer physics-pummeling force of the beginning of everything. At which point, the poor things are so tuckered out that they promptly lie down for a trillion-year nap. You can only see a wormhole if it happened to fall asleep with its mouth open. Otherwise, being mostly composed of minimally corporeal time and space and entropy and memory, with a sprinkling of platinum molecules and a dash of radioactive PTSD, they are perfectly camouflaged by the darkness of the interstellar void. They dream in 16 dimensions. They breathe once a millennium. Their language is nothing but umlauts. They drift, mindlessly through all that ever was, or is, or will be, drawn this way and that only by the smell of food that might flow effortlessly into their sleeping mouths. The giant panda eats bamboo. The wormhole eats regret. As anyone with a passing interest in self-help books knows, new quantum realities are being formed all over the place, any time some collection of hyperactive molecules decides between sushi and curry for dinner, or whether to marry their childhood sweetheart, or see what else the world has to offer, or whether to sort out how to derive energy from chlorophyll, or meat, or both, or neither. The universe is a very large and very complicated demonstration of having one's cake and eating it too. It sees no reason not to have it all. But most hyperactive molecules must proceed linearly along their own fork, unless they are a keshet, only grazing the surface of other timelines, as they yearn and brood and wonder what could have been. If only they had chosen the yellowfin sashimi. If they could have been satisfied with loving that one gorgeously familiar face. If they could now stand green in the warmth, drinking down the sun. It takes energy for new roads to diverge in new woods. And no energy is spent with complete efficiency without waste. Where wood has burned, there will be ash. The waste product of the constantly dividing multiverse is a fine, drifting mist of regret. And no wormhole has ever starved. A handful of these gentle space yaks found Luno Prime, a watering hole too good and too deep to ever leave. Two or three fell into a food coma so deep that their gaping mouths shut as they rolled on their sides, snoring soundlessly into oblivion. That's all. That's the reason behind the utter cultural and spatial dominance of the ooey-gooey Alunazar. They screwed up and chose poorly so often. They were so majestically sad that they drew a herd of wormholes to them like the steam from a fresh pie levitating a snoozing dog toward the windowsill on Mr. Looney of the Tunes. So what happened that day that whiplashed all those frigates and deep space miners and moons and pulsars and Muzmar's black bathtub and firefly-encrusted green elephants and Sid Vicious's complimentary Anjou pears. One yawned. A wormhole yawned in its sleep, and the yawn ricocheted through a stack of realities like a snapped power line. And suddenly, everyone could see a new glittering gap in the sky, and on the other side of that gap lay the far side of the galaxy. Unexplored, untapped, unreachable by the usual party ships until that moment. On the other side lay the Sieve, and the Vourpret, and the Volna, and an intelligent twilight mega-hurricane called Hrodos, and the Urshelas, and the 3-2-1, and the Smaragdi, and, far beyond even them, a small, watery, excitable planet called Earth. Unfortunately, the Yuz thought the Lunazar had blown their royals out of the sky. The Lunazar were convinced that the Yuz had decided to push back their colonies for no good reason at all. A band of Keshet single-timeline separatists took credit for the moons, but blamed the frigates on the Sloshit. The Uterak and the Meleg had disputed ownership of the Pulsar for generations, and each assumed the other had finally gotten sick of messing about discussing things like adults. And the Elecon quietly seethed about the theft of their long-dead Emperor's bathtub, but in order not to compound the offence by dishonouring Muzmar's philosophy of neutrality, simply started selling weapons to positively everyone. Half the Milky Way was already steaming by the time they encountered the meat of the other half. And the sentience wars progressed at record speed from confusion and posturing to, in technical terms, an intergalactic shitshow. Thankfully, the Sex Pistols weren't really much for apples and pears anyway, and never noticed anything amiss. 12. Come on, I'll give you a flower. In the 13 minutes and 11 seconds that elapsed between Aught Saint Ultraviolet waking from dreams of his daughters growing up and refusing to visit at Christmas, and the abrupt disappearance of Decibel Jones from the back seat of a gently used BMW 760Li, the entity known as the Roadrunner built a ship capable of travelling at many times the speed of light, engaging in a mild spot of dogfighting, providing roomy accommodations with plenty of lunch, life support, and legroom for four, and making the most advanced human aircraft wet itself and crumple into a heap, wondering just what it had been doing with its life. Aerospace engineers around the world, take note. The tall blue flamingo fish reached up and scooped the gelatinous green hair accessory off her head like a woman removing an earring at the end of a long day. The alien presented the gummy flower to two of the three absolute zeros with obvious pride, though it was no bigger than a paper water cooler cup, and parts of it were crusted over with tiny yellow and pinkish warts, and all of it smelled like Brighton Beach at low tide. "I require a substrate," chirped the Esker happily. "Are you terribly attached to your headphones?" Aught Saint Ultraviolet, deeply apologetic creator of the maddening earworm that was the current West Cornwall Pasty Company jingle, Live and Let Pie, somewhat reluctantly handed over his bespoke Koo and Co. oversized, over-ear, oversensitive headphones in the limited edition Phantom Pearl color scheme. "I promise you aught," said the Roadrunner with soothing protectiveness. "In terms of audiovisual equipment, anything you have down here, we can do better up there. And, well, everything else, too. It's not your fault. No one expects more from a species that still uses electric kettles." Very carefully, the Roadrunner slid her jellied barrette onto the left cup of the headphones and set it all down on Aught's coffee table. It wobbled there for a moment. Then thin, gluey tentacles shot out and covered the space where a human head was meant to fit with a fleshy, semi-transparent spider web. The mouth of the flower suckled at the air expectantly. The Esker poured a pint glass of whole milk directly into that almost obscene little polyp, then fed in a large, raw, well-marbled ribeye steak that Ort had fished out of the freezer and shoved into the microwave, whereupon the most piercingly awkward silence of his life descended as his estranged former bandmate and a giant feathered alien waited for the defrost cycle to finish.
"It's a kilo steak. I bought it to share with the girls on Saturday,"
Ort had mumbled sheepishly.
"Cheaper than buying three."
Capo meowed and glanced meaningfully at her empty food bowl.
"It takes 20 minutes.
He'd picked at his fingernails and prayed for death.
"Sorry."
The phlegmy flower chewed the defrosted meat down, inch by inch, with obvious satisfaction.
"Lucky thing you had ribeye,"
the roadrunner mused, unsettlingly, in Ort's mother's voice.
"We might have had to waste time popping down to the shop. Sirloin doesn't have the necessary fat content, you know. Fat's just the thing for spaceflight. Fat and calcium."
"I should call Justine,"
Ort said suddenly.
"The girls will worry."
But the man Rolling Stone once called Orpheus reincarnated as the holiday decor section of Debenhams
did not get to say what he wanted to tell his daughters or the wife he'd ignored in favor of a music studio far too many times, as things began to happen at an astonishing rate. Razor-sharp, metallic snowflakes erupted fractally out of the seaflower headphone combo platter. Fluorescent black coral shot out of it like parachutes deploying. Those thin tentacles, or stamens, or vines, or what have you, shot out everywhere, grabbing whatever they could find and cramming it into the rapidly expanding mint jelly maw. In went delicate glass sculptures from Baku, Paris, Łódź, Prague. Out burst pitted, rough red prongs that reminded Ort of the reef he'd snorkeled in the Maldives with Mark Ronson, just before Mark and the Maldives died. In went his juicer, his espresso machine, his electric kettle, his microwave. The thing on his coffee table vomited forth ropey sapphire starfish legs that wrapped around the table and gobbled that up too. The whole rubbish heap crashed to the floor, hauling in table lamps and the hallway chandelier after it. Tongues of spiral wire coral snatched his tablet projector, his wafer screen television, his gaming rig, his wine glasses. The little crusty warts polka-dotting the flower's distended gullet detonated, covering the now more or less Volkswagen-sized love child of the Great Barrier Reef and Ort's tastefully appointed suburban home in a swarm of what appeared to be yellow and fuchsia-striped fish. More polyps gushed out of the holes in the coral, some the same gummy jade color as the original, others in new and exciting wine pastille shades. Now their horrifying round mouths were ringed in a wild tentacular fringe, lurching down the hallway in search of pillows, linens, mobile phone chargers, and electronic readers. Ort St. Ultraviolet watched in abject despair. All the physical evidence of his life on Earth was being torn to pieces and keel-hauled into the maw of a hungry space flower, as though his marriage, his children, his stable work life, his healthy income and investments achieved through years of prudent selling out, and his study of good interior design, had just been a long, long setup for a truly mean-spirited punchline. He'd no idea what to do. He'd seen their band's name at the bottom of the aliens' list, even if, at the time, he'd thought it was a curry-induced dream. If Des was here, he'd probably already drafted them into an army of two to save the planet. Des would do anything you asked if you fluttered your eyelashes and told him he was good. And, Ort supposed, he would as well, only no one had fluttered anything yet. If he hauled off and told them to leave his things alone and get out, would that doom humanity? It had to be taken as a serious possibility. In the face of the wanton destruction of all he had ever held dear, Ort uttered a furious tut under his breath and, as that produced no result, gave up. Ort barely escaped, becoming one with the volcanic stake-fueled repo beast. His beloved autophone was not so lucky. Ultraviolet watched it get sucked down into the biological sinkhole in total horror. In went the hallway mirror, a vase full of Venetian glass dahlias, and Capo's water bowl. It was slowing down now, but only because it was running out of fuel and room to maneuver. It reminded Ort suddenly of those little brightly colored pills he'd loved as a kid. You put them in a sink full of water, and in 30 seconds they swelled up into a big foam dinosaur you could play with. However, this was not a foam dinosaur you could play with. It was a bespoke, late model, oversized, overhauled, overtalked, guaranteed to work even in the most inhospitable environments, wearable instant short-range combat shuttle in the limited edition Kaleidoscope of the Sea color scheme. 100% manufactured on Bataclik by your ever-discreet friends at the Urgama conglomerate. And it was almost finished. 2 mauve sea cucumbers shot out of the top of the infant ship and seized the gas range. 4 tangerine anemones ripped down the roof, leaving them standing in a gaping sinkhole in the middle of his once respectable neighborhood. Capo scrambled up his pant leg in a desperate panic, shrieking and leaving serious stab wounds in his calves. The Esker frowned, in as much as a beak like an upside-down boomerang can frown. She reached out one long, silvery blue frond and inserted it directly into the shelter cat's pink ear. Capo's eyes went wide. Her pupils blew out. She didn't shriek again. Her claws retracted, and Decibel caught her as she dropped like a rock off Ort's shoulder. Capo stared up at him, blinking furiously. Then she yawned. The ship rose high above them now, a mass of living coral and understated style, swathed in translucent cerulean jellyfish bells, and swarming with every ounce of symbiotic life you could cram into a flying ecosystem the size of a blue whale. The Roadrunner trilled joyfully. Her eyes filmed over briefly, just licking the surface of their memories. Your Uber has arrived. A hatch in the underside of the Urgama conglomerate instant short-range combat shuttle that had, a moment ago, been a white leather couch, opened before them. 6 carbonated glucoamino exhaust ports ignited in the belly of the stern with a sound like overexcited jacuzzi jets, casting candy cane-colored shadows on the ruins of a very nice place to live. While Decibel Jones and Ort St. Ultraviolet still managed to stand next to each other long enough to do the occasional Where Are They Now photo shoot, Danesh Yarlow and Omar Jalishkan had, in fact, not spoken for several years. Something about their never-completed third album, variously reported as having been titled Absence Leaves the Tart to Wander, Shag and Bone Man, or Papa Needs a New Pair of Prudent Investment Portfolios. Something about an autumn night in Edinburgh. Des, what is going on? Shouted Ort St. Ultraviolet in the sudden quiet, unable to maintain an upper lip of any kind for another second. We're going to save the planet, Decibel Jones said in the voice that launched 1,000 sexual awakenings. He slung his arm round his old boy Frack's waist. I thought you'd want to sit in. A moment later, all 3 of them, plus 1 white cat, ceased to occupy planet Earth. Remember that friendly, bouncing disco ball you were following? Hold on tight with everything you've got, because now that the band's back together, that shiny little minx is about to break orbit. 13. Everything has rhythm. The question has never been, can you build cities? Ants do that. The question has never been,
Are you capable of considering your own existence and getting kind of depressed about it? Any animal in captivity does that. The question has never been, can you use tools? Crows do that. Otters do that. Apes do that. Good Lord, everybody does that. The question has never been, can you perform complex problem solving? Dogs do that. The question has never been, can you experience love? Nobody doesn't. The question has never been, can you use language? Parrots and dolphins and cuttlefish do that. The question has never even been, do you understand object permanence? Can you recognize yourself in the mirror? Do you bury your dead? Do you bond emotionally with your young? Elephants do all those things, and some humans definitely don't. The only question is this. Do you have enough empathy and yearning and desperation to connect to others outside yourself and scream into the void in four-part harmony? Enough brain power and fine motor control and aesthetic ideation to look at feathers and stones and stuff that comes out of a worm's more unpleasant holes and see gowns, veils, platform heels. Enough sheer style and excess energy to do something that provides no direct material benefit to your personal survival, that might even mark you out from the pack as shiny, glittery prey. To do it for no other reason than it rocks. Everything in the universe has rhythm. Everything pulses to a beat laid down by the Big Bang. Everything feels the drumline of creation from star to sex to song. But can you make that rhythm? In order to create a pop band, the whole apparatus of civilization must be up and running and tapping its toe to the beat. Electricity, poetry, mathematics, sound amplification, textiles, arena architecture, efficient mimetic exchange, dramaturgy, industry, marketing, the bureaucratic classes, cultural critics, audiovisual transmission, special effects, music theory, symbology, metaphor, transportation, banking, enough leisure and excess calories to do anything beyond hunt. All of it. Everything. Can everyone else trust that, if you must declare war and wipe out half a quadrant, you'd at least write a sad song about it? Yes? Well, even that is not quite enough. Are you kind enough, on your little planet, not to shut that rhythm down? Not to crush underfoot the singers of songs and tellers of tales and wearers of silk. Because it's monsters who do that. Who extinguish art. Who burn books. Who ban music. Who yell at anyone with ears to turn off that racket. Who cannot see outside themselves clearly enough to sing their truth to the heavens. Do you have enough goodness in your world to let the music play? Do you have soul? Air. Go sing it like a hummingbird, the greatest anthem ever heard. Heroes. Mons Zermelov. 14. Vampires are alive. Mira and Ort were wrong, by the way, on the night they met Decibel Jones and discussed the nature of extraterrestrial culture and determined the course of their entire lives via scoops of pistachio, coconut, and mango gelato. There are shy, nerdy, predator scientists. The things of thing world will, very occasionally, venture beyond the opportunities afforded to them by 24/7 slaughter parties and exploding blood. Scorpions do go to the moon. Take, for example, the Yurtmak of planet Yunt, a deranged gutterball of gas jungles and carnivorous rivers hurtling through the beer bottle-strewn lanes of the gravitational bowling alley that is Septuple star system New Scorpii.
Improbably, the body of an adult yurtmak is basically the same as a human's, if slightly a snailier color, and capable of producing a pernicious pheromone from its nipples that has an effect on the IQ of any foreign visitor similar to the effect of a folding chair on a professional wrestler. Unfortunately for all of us, they also have heads. The head of a yurtmak can best be described as what you would get if a hippo mated with a chainsaw and produced something you wouldn't let into public school even with a hat on, who then went on to have an unhappy affair with a spiny pufferfish, whereupon, at the height of a particularly pustulant, turgid puberty, the resulting grandchild's face exploded. The yurtmak are obligate carnivores, for whom murder occupies the same cultural space as football does for humans in a World Cup year, complete with merchandising, celebrity players followed by hordes of fans, and families gathering of a Sunday to bond over the spectacle, maybe hitting the backyard to show off a few trick shots for the kids. Yet, the famed philosopher and beloved children's author, Gauguinar Gorkanen, was yurtmak. Even as a juvenile, her carnage was workmanlike and derivative at best, leaving her outcast, underemployed, and unpopular with men of her peer group, despite the best efforts of modern yurt-wide dating services. Gauguinar took this reasonably well, for a yurtmak. Carefully avoiding major organs, she fondly stabbed her mother and father goodbye and vanished into the wilderness. Eventually, she settled down, built herself a traditional heart valve hut in the depths of the fluoro-chloro forest of Yelea, and buckled down to invent a way, anyway, to get off that rock full of socially challenged chainsaw-faced hooligans. That is what Mira and Ort forgot, having been, if not popular, always cool. No matter how mad, bad, and dangerous to know a civilization gets, unto every generation are born the lonely and the uncool, destined to forever stare into the candy store window of their culture. And loneliness is the mother of ascension. Only the uncool have the requisite alone time to advance their species. And so it was that, eventually, between drawing meat ship schematics in the dirt and dreaming of a world where she didn't hate literally everyone, the shyest and most sensitive of yurtmaks began to plan the most ambitious massacre in the history of the galaxy. The murder of stupidity. The fateful weapon? A large print, mildly venomous picture book for which the general galactic population feels a level of affection and tender attachment that falls somewhere between Newton's Principia Mathematica and Goodnight Moon. Gauguinar Gorkanen's Unkillable Facts contains 99.9% pure, reliable, and comprehensive laws of the universe, as observed by an underachieving, socially anxious mutant murder hippo, and is considered to be as essential to a healthy, balanced childhood as hugs, nightlights, and cellular division. It is nearly impossible to forget one of Gauguinar Gorkanen's unkillable facts. The gently envenomated pages produce flashes of temporary but breathtakingly colorful pain as you turn them, so that the simple, heartfelt prose is charred into the reader's sense memory with incredible efficiency. This is Gauguinar's second general unkillable fact. For everything that exists, somewhere in the universe, there is a creature that eats it, breathes it, fucks it, wears it, secretes, perspires, exhales, or excretes it. If you want to argue with me on this one, consider the brick-breathing beast of Balan IV and shut your cake hole. You have already heard the first general fact. Life is beautiful, and life is stupid. It goes on to add, you can only ever fix one of these at a time, and wouldn't it be nice if anyone could agree on which one is the bigger problem? Given her sales numbers, Gauguinar Gorkanen, assassin of ignorance, is, to this day, idolized among the Yurtmak throughout the seven slaloming stars of the new Scorpi system, as the greatest serial killer ever to play the game. Perhaps, if humans had been able to read Gogonar Gorkanon and the First General as a bedtime story like everyone else, they wouldn't have had such a terribly tough time figuring out the whole trick with interstellar spaceships. 15. The ship is leaving tonight. Every civilization comes to the creation of an iconic ship design in their own way and in their own time, just as methodically and tenderly as a planet comes to the configuration of its favorite species. It simply cannot be rushed and, once arrived at, is rarely abandoned. Ask any child to draw a house, and though there may be variations in chimney placement or door shape, it will be recognizable to anyone with as many limbs and lobes as that child as a house. A ship, lovingly crafted by the gravity, raw materials, anatomical pluses and minuses, architectural traditions, and functional to fabulous score of its species at the time of mass driver invention, is no less cozy and relaxing than the drawings of a house made by the innocent hands of untraumatized juveniles. It is, therefore, entirely impossible to mistake one world's fleet for another. No matter how tactically advantageous such camouflage might be, it's just not comfy, so why make things more unpleasant for everyone? One would never confuse the soft, stacked bubbles of a Lunazar tuft ship for the single, hollowed-out moon gem of an Uteruk octahedral sloop, or the living wicker ball of a Keshet chloro frigate for the classic silver saucers of the Smaragdi. And no one could ever see an aggressively colorful coral reef floating in space and not know that the Esker had come to town. The one vehicular commonality among all the millions of spacefaring species, past, present, future, and prefer not to state, is that it is easier, cheaper, and more fun to grow than to build. This is what Gogonar Gorkanon discovered in the carbonated shadows of the fluoro-chloro forest of Yelea as she tried to invent a way out of loneliness. And it led both to the impressive horror tonnage of the Yurtmak meat ship and that marvelous second general unkillable fact. For everything that exists, somewhere in the universe, there is a creature that eats it, breathes it, fucks it, wears it, secretes, perspires, exhales, or excretes it. Somewhere on Yunt, there was a mammal the size of a convention center, stuck taxonomically between a bear and a crocodile, the decomposition of whose fresh corpse produced the exact type of gases necessary, when combined with the electrostatic ion acid sap of Yelea trees, to propel the entire disgusting mass of itself into orbit. Somewhere on Earth is an insect that excretes a golden antibacterial ooze that also does a splendid job sweetening your tea. A terribly picturesque tree whose bark will fix your malaria right up, and a large, four-legged, two-horned mammal whose reproductive system dispenses ice cream, brie, and buttercream frosting. But somewhere on Bataclic was an invertebrate coral polyp who, when combined with the profit motive of the Uagama conglomerate research and development bog, could digest a sudden overdose of fat, iron, riboflavin, calcium, and whatever else was unlucky enough to be within a roughly 6-meter radius, and crap out a spaceship. And, like overbearing parents pressuring their introverted, artistically inclined children into becoming rich doctors who jump the karaoke queue, the Esker managed, with a little positive reinforcement and an orgy of gene splicing, to railroad their local bioluminescent moon jellies into inhaling stellar radiation through their translucent bells and exhaling a healthful oxygen-nitrogen mix, their version of sea cucumbers into ejaculating explosive saltwater plasma at any nearby enemies, their brand of furry brine shrimp into eating space debris and vomiting defensive shields, their six-eyed mussels into filtering solar energy and converting it to usable propulsion, schools of something very like over-emotional clownfish into flushing bright green in the presence of foreign long-range radio waves or working FTL drives, and, perhaps most impressively for an aquatic creature lacking anything like the proper glandular setup, their freshwater starfish into sweating gravity. For an Uagama conglomerate wearable instant short-range combat shuttle, the trip from Earth to the Moon took approximately the length of time necessary for the Roadrunner to explain all this to her cargo of aging rock stars, look puzzled at their response, and ask, "What do you mean nothing on your planet excretes spaceships?" The small ambassadorial vessel docked in lunar orbit loomed up outside a porthole punched in the fluorescent coral wall at "what?" drew closer at "planet," and by the time of the question mark, they could see nothing but the massive bulk of the Esker frigate. If their shuttle was a nice reef in the Maldives, the real interstellar cruise ship was the Great Barrier Reef touched by the drunken god of space, time, and saltwater aquariums. High above the dark side of the moon floated a hypercolored goulash of coral only slightly smaller than Sardinia, studded with all of the above. The unfiltered light of Earth's familiar yellow sun sparkled on the electric blue and sizzling pink bells of jellyfish, who had clearly cleaned their plates at every supper. They were absolutely massive, encasing the entire reef ship in a protective barrier of neon mesogliastic skin, their tentacles clustering beneath the craft like a sloppy Christmas bow, ready and eager to dock with any vessel secreting a friendly venom formulation. On the starboard flank of the ship, in pristine, enormous English letters, a swarm of phosphorescent sea worms spelled out the name of the Great Esker Interstellar Ship. Cake in the Rain. The Roadrunner trilled joyfully in the distinct tones of a movie trailer voiceover. "Look, friends, it's not such a big, scary galaxy out for blood. We respect your primitive culture so deeply that we have named an entire reef ship in your honor. You see, even if the song of your people falls flat, we will carry on the best of you into the universe's promising future." Ort St. Ultraviolet took a breath to say something about the utter and complete nonsense of the entire London Aquarium hanging out on the unfashionable end of the moon, with the most rubbish lyric in history blinking on and off on its side like a broken pub sign, and demand, once again, that someone explain the last 20 minutes to him, but slowly this time, and with short words. But before he could turn that breath into words, a gulping sound, halfway between a champagne bottle opening and an octopus sucker latching on, popped their ears painfully as the shuttle corked itself into the mothership's mollusk-encrusted cloaca, and the airlock began to equalize the pressure between the two ships. On the wall of the shuttle, the encorrelated remains of Ort's microwave display counted down helpfully in large blue numbers. On the other side of the jelly glass docking hatch, they could see, improbably, impossibly, a hyperactive red panda jumping up and down and waving his paws at them. "That is E," said the blue flamingo. "He is our mandatory Keshet and my extremely best friend. You will probably like him better than you like me. Everyone does. I accept that." The microwave numbers ticked down slowly. There was nothing to do but wait until the next insanity rushed in with the airflow. Decibel tapped his foot awkwardly. "You look great, Ort." Still teaching?" "I have two kids, you arse," Ort replied. You couldn't ever really get mad at Des,
He didn't mean anything by not being able to retain information that didn't concern himself, music, sex, movies, or, bizarrely, aught had found one night on the tour bus to Dublin, 19th-century literature, for more than an hour or two. Especially when he smiled sheepishly and dragged that million-watt focus back onto you. That sheepish smile killed him every time. Aught used to find it endearing and even enviable. Decibel Jones always lived in the moment. Omar Jalushkin always lived in an uncertain future. Mira, he supposed, had always lived in her own head and allowed others to visit once in a while, with advance notice and extensive decontamination protocols. "Excuse me, babies," said the roadrunner, in what both of them instantly recognized as the voice of their old manager, Lila Poole. "But you gotta supper up before a show. How many times have I told you? I swear, you can lead a punk to stardom, but you can't make it eat." The esker held up one of Ort's much-used white lacquered tea trays, the handles of which were now fully colonized by vermilion brain coral. On it lay three glass saucers, and on each one of those sat two servings of something that looked a lot like a very expensive mushroom, something that looked like a squashed licorice allsort from the bottom of the bag, and something that looked like a cappuccino, if the barista had won several prizes for latte art, but had an unfortunate seizure while drawing a quadratic equation in your milk foam. "This is some hardcore triple X keeper in the back room under a curtain. Alice in Wonderland action is what this is," Decibel said with total delight. "Is it lunch?" His hand was already halfway to one of the mushrooms. That was the power of Lila Poole's indefatigably upbeat boardroom mum North Country voice. If Lila said to do it, it was good for you, good for the band, and probably good for humankind at large. And it had been so long. A feeling of oceanic calm he hadn't felt in years descended over Decibel Jones. Someone else was taking care of the details. Someone else was handling logistics. Thank Christ. "I really, really think we need to have a serious discussion about food allergies before we start eating space all sorts," Ort fretted, but he was too under the spell of their old Lila-fueled agreeableness. "Because peanuts are nothing compared to what, I presume, grows on some artisanal asteroid on the underside of the universe. Do you cats have an MHRA? FDA? Anything?" "Don't whine, kittens. It's not lunch. Think of these as the jabs for your Pan-Asian tour. There's your Hep A, there's your Hep B, there's your typhoid vaccine. Not everybody you'll meet is as conveniently pneumonopathic, oxygen-breathing, and gravitationally compatible as your girl Friday here. The mushroom's actually a dormant fungal agent that will infect your brainstem with a pretty laid-back strain of Jumpian encephalitis." "Whoa, whoa, whoa!" shouted Des and Ort. They leaped back as though the tea tray were full of spiders and credit card bills. Decibel tried to recover quickly, telling himself that he really ought to have gotten over any squeamishness with regards to alien biological compounds back in Croydon. But it was instinctive, as deep as dirt. "Take it easy. Jesus Christ, you gotta learn to trust a little. You'd think I'd threatened to wipe out your whole planet. Ha ha, my little joke. That all completely safe. I promise. Look, my whole job is getting you to Letost in one piece and ready to shine. So I wouldn't hurt you for love nor money, nor socio-political advantage. Friends, Decibel, Ort, lend me your ears. Only speaking languages you've actually learned is a sign of a healthy mind. Where's the fun in that? Once your cute wee antibodies get a load of Jumpian encephalitis, they'll start working like the rent's due tonight. You know how your nose gets all snotty and your throat swells up when you have the flu? Well, turns out, as long as you're carbon-based and keep your brain on the inside, The body's natural immune response to this is to produce a kind of linguistic acid reflux that blows out the bits of your brain that insist on having to conjugate and decline and punctuate things before it can understand them, like cheap subwoofers. Doesn't work on the yumps, though. Poor sods. They're pretty resentful about it. You haven't seen anything until you've seen pot-bellied play-saws trying to speed-read through 16 local phrase books at once. Oh, you two are now officially allergic to penicillin. That shit clears the infection right up. Right. So, the All Sorts is just gonna paste in some of the Ursula's junk DNA and mutate your lungs into being a bit less closed-minded when it comes to respiratory partners, and the coffee is just a caffeine jolt to your inner ear with a nice foamy agile gravity agent so you don't barf, drift off, or explode when we land. Thank the yuz. It's mostly their toenails. We share up here, you know. Makes it a homier galaxy for everyone. Plus, if you don't open source your assets, we quarantine your planet, and any further attempts to holiday outside your system will be met with big, big cannons. I mean, giant. Huge. Still, it's all right, isn't it? A couple of bites and a slurp, and you're ready for anything. It's like Gogonar's fourth general unkillable fact says. Everyone's always saying love is the element that binds the universe together. But that's a load of bollocks. It's convenience. All things, from evolution to municipal sanitation, to marriage to the Big Bang, to diplomacy, to the distribution of shops in urban centres, trend toward the most convenient outcome for the greatest number of lazy bastards. Because the inconvenient stuff ends up alone, without any friends and a foot growing out of their head, and who has the time?
This is disgusting, Oort Ultraviolet snorted.
This is amazing, Des whispered. Much less invasive than Heathrow Customs, anyway.
Oort's microwave chimed. Their docking procedures had finished defrosting. A cheerful blue popcorn kernel made of Asterix signalled the completion of the decompression cycle.
You know I'd never hurt you.
Mira's throaty voice came pouring out of that dark, alien beak.
Hey, said Oort quietly. Don't. You don't have to do that.
Do what, baby?
Talk like Mira, or Lila, or my dad, or Dessa's Nan, or anyone.
Do you not enjoy it? Does it not put you at ease?
No. Just be normal. Just be yourself. Just be whatever passes for an ordinary sort of bloke where you come from. Like me, see? Decibel can swan about and, well, if you'd ever met her, Mira could make eyes at you and turn you to jelly in an instant. But I'm just Omar. I like music and football and a laugh, and half the reason the band lasted as long as it did is that I'm so easy to get along with that those two only ever had each other to pick on. It's fine. We don't need to be at ease. This isn't an at-ease kind of gig. And honestly, it's really, really creepy.
The bird's fishy eyes narrowed.
You don't really like football. I can see it in your cerebral structure.
But I want to like it, and that's just as good in the end. Just be the roadrunner. Be like me, and when he starts up being Des again, which he will, you and I can go smoke a ciggy together and make fun of his accent. Deal?
Deal, Mr. Ultraviolet.
The airlock released. A 7-foot-tall blue bird punched a gold-plated starfish, and Decibel Jones and the last of the absolute zeros stepped from obscurity onto the biggest stage in the universe.
16. I am a real boy. The 19th Metagalactic Grand Prix was held on Palul, the Smaragdi homeworld. It was the first time a species who did not fight in the war
on account of their having been minding their own business at the time, toddling about with endearing hesitance on their own moons, and not bothering anyone except the moon bears, attempted to sing their way into the upper echelons of galactic society. Contrary to popular opinion concerning the desirability of getting in early on Alpha Centauri real estate development, Pulul is the nearest planet to Earth that wouldn't entirely murder any human being who set foot on it. At the very least, you'd have time to get a nice shark's heart sausage in at one of Blue Rutu's finer bistros before the low-gravity, high-pressure atmosphere and the global, rather well-founded cynicism on the subject of strangers started rather dramatically forcing blood out of the ends of your hair. Some 40 light-years away, in the constellation of Aquarius, Pulul revolves around an ultra-cool blue dwarf star that the humans have designated TRAPPIST-1. The Smaragdi, however, call their pale, minimalist sun Lagon, a word that means, in their exceedingly specific language, a spouse who habitually withholds affection but comes through with a squeeze when you really need them and always pays the bills on time. Pulul itself means the parent who gives and gives, but it is never enough for their ungrateful children, who will probably never amount to anything anyway. Among the Smaragdi, self-deprecation has been refined into an art. You have not truly embraced the possibilities of intergalactic life until you have awkwardly nibbled vapor cheese and drunk platinum wine at a stand-up modesty show on Pulul. It is a cold, crystal place covered in cold, crystal oceans and warm, crystal people. At least, it was. Because Lagom is never much in the mood for the whole sensually nurturing solar warmth gig, Pulul is a semi-hollow world. If you were to stand on the opal-crusted peak of Mount Alinen, far from the lights of the great Smaragdi cities, and look into the sky, you would see, just before your eyelashes started bleeding, what the ancient Smaragdi were doing while life on Earth was just sorting out whether two cells could ever really be better than one. Even the Alunazar were astonished when they careened drunkenly into this little world of grotesque monsters surrounded by engineering's answer to the Sistine Chapel. Unfortunately for them, the Smaragdi seem to have been created in a lab for the express purpose of scaring the salt water out of an Alunazar. A Smaragdin looks very much as though someone built the most unnecessarily elaborate set of 18th century Spanish plate armor out of bleached ivory and quartz, gave it a head of blue-white hair like a 1970s shampoo commercial, stretched the whole thing out to 9 or 10 feet like particularly stern and judgmental taffy, then thought it might be a bit intimidating, and painted a bit of pastel green and lavender on the joint blades for a more festive spring look. The overall effect would seem quite beautiful and haunting to a human, but to a short, technicolor invertebrate, a Alunazar, they look like the devil's own skeleton. Pulul is snugly encased in Old Rutu's bindle, a cross-hatched topiary of translucent solar rods, designed by the classical poet-engineer Old Rutu to catch Lagom's emotionally unavailable light, beef it up a bit, and direct it usefully to the most inhabited parts of the surface. The glaciated surface of Pulul was suddenly polka-dotted with pools of Rutu-blessed artificial alpine climate, full of silver ferns, blue-grey orchards, heavy with gin fruit, and liquid oceans, in which the neon-blooded soufflet sharks swim free. The name of Old Rutu is, among the Smaragdi, spoken with an awe equivalent to Jesus Christ and Nikola Tesla borrowing Buddha's tandem bicycle for a quick Sunday ride through Shakespeare's back garden. On Activation Day, every city on Pulul scrambled to rename itself after him, which caused a great deal of confusion, upset feelings, cancelled family reunions, Rutu absolutely forbidding anyone to do any such stupid thing, as it was no big deal, I was up there anyway, might as well do a spot of DIY while I've still got my health, you know, if you have someone in they'll only rip you off, And besides, you'd all do the same for me. Anyway, it's a bit rubbish. I was in a rush. 2 regional wars, and a small but feisty economic crisis. Until it was decided that everyone was pretty, they all loved the old man equally, and there was quite enough Rutu to go around. And the map-makers would just have to seek out anxiety medication. Hence, on Palul, you will find no London, Paris, Vlimu, or Alun, but only blue Rutu, white Rutu, little Rutu, new Rutu, Rutu by the sea, dirty Rutu, broke-down Rutu, backwards Rutu, and so on and so forth. Controversially, the 22nd Metagalactic Grand Prix was held in dirty Rutu, the smaragdy answer to Prague, once the capital of a great empire, torn apart by war, religion, vanished industry, and tourists who know in their hearts that it's not wrong to get so phenomenally plastered that you punch a police horse, because everyone knows horses vote Tory, just so long as you do it while ignoring some of the most sublime architecture in the universe. The general idea was that, whether or not the Yurtmak turned out to be sentient, it would be rather poor form to rub their alleged noses in the cosmopolitan delights of Blue Rutu, and then send them home full of envy and the slow, wistful poisoning of a farm boy's dissatisfaction with his pigs after he has seen palaces. Even if they ended up having to roast the poor things shortly afterward, it just didn't seem very nice. No one expected much of anything out of the Yurtmak in the way of danceable pop hits. The Uterak had discovered their world by accident, and immediately wished they hadn't. The first officer on a deep space fishing boat, hunting the vast, delicious and deadly Zabok crabs that scuttled through the galaxy, suckling at hidden tide pools of dark matter, picked up the faint broadcast of what their xenoanthropologist surmised was a folk festival, emanating from a little planet by the name of Yunt. Had the Uteruk then required all Zabok trawlers to carry accredited translators on board, as they do now, the poor Uteruk commander would have known right away that the folk festival in question was the Yurtmak Super Murder Derby 9000, and very likely turned right around and headed toward the safer embraces of giant dark matter crabs in the lonely depths of the void. The Yurtmak were clownishly violent, disgusting to look at, in possession of a language that sounded like someone enthusiastically smashing pots and pans together in a hot tar pit, and hadn't even gotten around to inventing agriculture before somehow, bafflingly, managing spaceflight. They were exactly the sort of species the sentience wars had raged across the known cosmos to prevent from getting too big for their interstellar trousers. But rules are rules. No blowing up the horrifying death goblins next door without a bit of song and dance first. The Sieve won that year, being a group intelligence comprised of hot pink algae, genetically fused with nanocomputational spores. The Sieve never formed rock bands per se. They sent the same supergroup to the Grand Prix every year, some 60% of their species, decanted into artful vases, and simply called Us. They sang by pheromone, a crescendo of infectious hormones that maddened the mating instincts of every species in the dirty Rutu flophouse and grill, a vast, glittering, state-of-the-art performance arena seating over 100,000, until the slightest whisper sounded like a techno-erotic laser light show of the soul. At which point, Us spilled out of their vases in an undulating rosy wave, spun up into a towering spiral of velvet sparkling life, and sang an ancient Sieve folk ballad called Love is Easy When You're a Hive Mind, coupled with a thumping, thrusting, subwoofer-slaughtering beat, dispersing on the downbeat, slamming back into their magenta spire on the upbeat, and bringing the house all the way down. Yatagan Yump, Murder Derby champion and celebrated torch singer, walked across the spotless frozen floor of the flophouse, dressed in a traditional Yurtmak lung gown, her dripping, pustulant face hidden beneath a black veil so long it wrapped twice around the stage. She held something in her arms. The lights turned red and heavy and dim, a slow drum pulsed. Yatagan tore open the veil with her claws and revealed her instrument, the skeleton of her mate, cleaned and polished and hollowed, so that when she wrapped her arms around him and tenderly kissed his fangs, her breath filled up his bones and emerged from his rib cage as a savage and anguished melody called "Death is a Wish Your Fists Make." "It's not what you think," went the chorus. "Don't be afraid. To love is to slaughter. To slaughter is to love. But by the rocks below and the rocks above, you don't do either one unless the other guy's really into it." At the conclusion of the song, which went on to become a popular choice for wedding DJs, Yatagan set herself on fire and burned to death in front of everyone with a smile on her face, waving delightedly to her fans as the audience threw flowers into her pyre and watched them sizzle up into the heavens. The judging was not quick. 100,000 dinners were ordered in from neighbouring Rutus. In the early hours of the next morning, it was decided, by a very slim margin, that Yatagan Yump and all her people were undeniably alive, intelligent, and possessed of a complex inner life. Especially since the Uterek had really phoned it in that year, with the entirely forgettable "Shall I Compare Thee to a Dark Matter Crab?" Yet, if not for Yatagan Yump's sacrifice, the galaxy's children would never have grown up under the not terribly gentle ministrations of Goganar Gorkanon's Unkillable Facts, the 20th of which, penned for the occasion of the 23rd Grand Prix on Yint, is: "No one is ever really satisfied with what they've got. Look at that skinny bastard old Rutu. He heated up his whole planet like a leftover takeaway. And he still wasn't really that happy, if you ask me. People are mostly happiest when they think they're just about to get the thing they want most. Before and after, they're all monsters." 17. Every Way That I Can.
"Hi. Hi. Hi, hi.
Hello, hi." Ought St. Ultraviolet and Decibel Jones, individually and collectively, assumed the time-travelling red panda called E, leaped up as they boarded, made a high-pitched squealing noise, and careened over backward waving his paws in the air because he was just so feverishly excited to meet them. However, among the Keshet, this is a cool, eminently diplomatic, even standoffish greeting. Down to the soles of its cells, a Keshet is a constant atomic, temporal, and emotional ball pit into which an infinite army of cake-addled toddlers jumps over and over, and it is every single one of their birthdays forever. And he wasn't happy to see them at all.
"E, E, E, E is me, and you are them, and we are all, but whoa! Wait, wait, stop, wait! Are you not Yoko Ono? What, how, what the fuck, Al? I gave you a picture of her and everything. Do all primates still look the same, same, identical, same to you? We practiced, Al. We practiced all the way here. It was so boring."
"Al?" Des asked. "You're not Al. Al runs a chip shop on the corner. Al fixes the furnace. You're the Roadrunner.
That's what you call me. And look, Des, I like you a lot. But I've nibbled heaps of memories in the last 24 hours, so I know what a Looney Tunes is. And frankly, I think it's a bit insensitive. E's time is far too valuable and volatile to dribble it away calling me Alternaut who runs faster than wisdom down the Milk Road. But at least he uses part of my actual name, because that's respect, isn't it?"
"Sorry," mumbled Decibel. "Sorry," Ought Ultraviolet repeated with a shrug.
"No, no, no, yes, yes, no. I love it. It's perfect. Far way, far better than Al. We receive the Dog and Bird and Bomb and Canyon show in the big radio wave hall off this world. It was excellent, great, excellent, all right. A song of nihilism and hopelessness of desire. At first, we thought it was such an obvious allegory for the war that we ignored it. Must be one of us. You know, yeah, you know, no? Some pirate cartoon channel out of Octave Space junking up the signal. Nope. Coincidence, chance, chance, fate, chance. An echo in the great unconscious. I hate that. Makes my job harder. But it's perfect, perfect.